Welcome everybody to this week's Sales Lunchtime Seminar. Thank you very much for coming on. Today I'm pleased to have Professor Dr. Martinson with us. We have very similar research interests in EU welfare, social policy, and also trying to understand legal integration from a kind of law and political science perspective. Dr. Is at the University of Copenhagen in their Department of Political Science. Her interest in the last years has been in thinking about the relationship between courts and political actors, the EU legislature, and what her 2015 book with Oxford University Press was on the title of today's talk, which is about an ever more powerful court, the political constraints on legal integration in the European Union. So I think what we will get today is a very strong interdisciplinary sense of how we should think about the European Court. And with that, thank you very much for coming to visit us today.
Thank you very much, Kenneth. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm very happy with the invitation and coming here and present what I have done for the last years and a research project that I conducted since 2010, which ended up in this book that came out with Oxford University Press about 2 years ago. So this one. And if I should say very briefly formulated what my research is about and what is written in this book, it's about the relationship between legal integration, so decisions taken by the Court of Justice of the European Union in Luxembourg, and political integration. So what is this interaction between law and politics in the European Union? What influence does the Court of Justice have on political decision making? And what are the abilities of political actors to respond to legal integration? And this is a research interest which I have had continuously and have had since my PhD at the EUI in Florence, where I did a joint degree between law and political science. So I'm a political scientist with a keen interest in law, so to speak.
And I think the other way around.
That's fair enough. Okay. I also think that some of the really strong puzzles that we should engage in as scholars demand interdisciplinary takes on it, or at least understanding that we need to contextualize from our own discipline then, in order to be able to undertake and engage as scholars in some of the most important challenges to the European Union, but also to political systems, to law in the age of globalization, so to speak. So what I will do here is that I'll situate my study in the broader debate on EU integration between law and politics. I will then argue for a need to revisit some of the conventional understandings of this relationship. And I'll present how I did this in my book and what came out of it. So this is a sort of the line of my talk here. So this is where my research starts. A judgment has been rendered in the Court of Justice of the European Union. The voice of law has spoken. What becomes its implications? This is my interest, so to speak. So my book aimed to uncover what becomes of law after it leaves the hands of the judiciary and enters legislative politics, with all its battles, with all its fights, its compromises, and also dialogues. There are two ways I believe that we can study the broader impact of legal integration, and we should engage in that study from our different scholarly views. Two ways. So one is to study its impact at the national level. So is jurisprudence complied with by the member states? Is it implemented in the member states? And I do that in other parts of my studies, but this is not what I will present here. The other way we can engage and examine the broader impact of the court's jurisprudence is to look into its legislative impact, so to speak. So does it influence policy outputs in the European Union. So when the court's interpretation changes, so to speak, the established regulatory status quo, so what we thought the treaty meant, or what the political actors thought they agreed on in a piece of secondary legislation, when that is interpreted by the European Court, eventually in an activist way, in an expansive way, is it then codified? That means, is it accepted and written into political decisions? This is, so to speak, the relationship between legal integration and political integration. So I find that the legislative impact of jurisprudence and the political ability to respond to legal integration is highly important for a range of questions, including democratic politics, also legitimacy, in the age of Europeanization. So what became the legislative effect of all the jurisprudence where working time was extended, the understanding of working time was expanded, the export of social assistance benefits across borders was extended by the European Court of Justice, the ability to seek healthcare in another member state, or the jurisprudence that limited workers' rights to take collective actions, that is to strike against what was regarded as social dumping. What became the broader policy implications of that? Existing studies of the relationship between legal integration and political integration has long been dominated by a neo-functionalist paradigm in theoretical terms, or in more judicial terms, a paradigm of constitutionalization or juridicalization. So also a narrative, a very strong narrative of a progressive expansion of judicial integration. These are paradigms which have considerable implications for also beyond academia, and I think they have had also in the UK and the Brexit debate. So it's presented as legal integration at the expense of politics. So a rather unconstrained power of the eustocracy. And just to take an example of such a presentation of judicial power in the European Union, we can here take the opening line of Alex Stone Sweet's rather famous book, Governing with Judges, from 2000, where he writes, "Parliamentary supremacy, understood by most students of European politics to be the constitutive principle of European politics, has lost its vitality. After a polite nostalgic nod across the channel to Westminster, we can declare it dead. The work of governments and parliaments is today structured by an ever-expanding web of constitutional constraints. In a word, European policymaking has been juridicalized or judicialized." So this is a theoretical assumption which has had quite a big implication also on public opinion about the power of the European Court of Justice. And the neo-functionalist kind of idea is that because we don't see example of constitutional override of the court, or we see few examples of them, in essence, the court cannot be curbed by politics. So it is the judicial power which is trumping politics. And the view, the presentation from neo-functionalism is that in the law and politics relationship, law is winning with a landslide. So I argue then that this is a very untested assumption, which is based on landmark decisions, and which do not study these landmark decisions' broader impact, how they affect the national level, and how they affect EU legislative politics, or at least do not have very consistent, consolidated methods for doing so. But that there is a need to critically revisit this interplay between law and politics, and to examine law in context, or the way politics is actually able to respond to law also in the age of Europeanization. It is clear that the legal order is foreclosing certain policy options. The constitutional expansion and the reading by the court of certain fundamental principle in the European legal order as foreclosing many policy options by the member states, but we should look into, as scholars, what then arises instead, and what creative solutions member states and also EU legislative politics is using to sort of maintain certain autonomy and maintain certain decision-making power also in this frame of EU legal integration. So just to close this presentation of the kind of theoretical or broader paradigm of viewing the relationship between law and politics, the dominant scholarly view, which I also argue is the dominant view in public opinion, has become the dominant view in public opinion, is a presentation of a dynamic court view. So the dynamic between legal and political integration is presented here as a stage model. So this is kind of the neo-functional way of presenting the law and politics relationship. It's a stage model where we have clear causal link between the different parts of the stages. We have interaction between actors, which creates sort of incomplete contracts between those actors. That then demands third-party dispute resolution, so that is litigation, which is then pushing for legislation, for political kind of clarity on what the court here is interpreting. And there's an inherently expansive logic to this stage model, where it is sort of self-sustaining, and it's also kind of irreversible. So the core link is this one, for my interest, but also this is the driving feature of the model. It's the link between integration to law and political integration, which comes from law onto political integration. The argument is, and the finding of this paradigm is, that litigation will be codified into political decisions. It will be accepted, as the court more or less is interpreting it, into decisions. So the explanation is also that this political power of the court is in part explained by the inability of politics to react in a coherent manner, because politics is too fragmented nowadays, and certainly is in the European Union, to establish sufficient majorities to correct the court. And also political actors are not essentially interested in the long-time effects of judicial decisions. Their time horizon is rather short, so they don't manage, you know, to engage in the longer implication of legal integration. So if jurisprudence goes against political preferences, politicians are paralyzed by their inability to establish these majorities, political majorities, and therefore they cannot correct a court interpretation. So this makes it possible for the court to have a successful inroad into political decision making and for generating change. So that is sort of the context and the paradigm that I try to question, and where I then develop my hypothesis for my study from. So this is really my flow. This is what I am interested in studying in this book and is doing here. The Court of Justice is rendering a controversial decision. We have seen that many times. I'm sure you can remember various. What then happens often after such a controversial decision is that we see the head of states reacting. It's causing a certain political uproar, you could argue, critique. And the heads of states will sometimes argue for the need to overrule the court's jurisprudence, to re-establish legal certainty, but then reality kicks in, the reality of politics, and the requirement of supermajorities, and also kind of mega-sized institutional thresholds, which cannot be overcome. Because a constitutional override of the court's jurisprudence, of course, requires a treaty amendment. And we know very well that that is close to impossible. So this is kind of what we argue against here. So because the head of states do not manage to do such a constitutional override, The assumption is that proves juridicalization, that that proves the inability of politics to respond in a sufficient matter, in a sufficient manner, to the course of legal integration that it didn't really want anyway. But if we study it in the long time run, and we also look into the daily decision-making processes of European politics, such decisions are actually addressed by means of secondary legislation in the daily decision-making processes of the European Union. So what will happen after such a decision is that the Commission will either take it up, and it will argue for the need to have it codified into secondary legislation, or to somehow respond to it in a more constraining manner. So the Commission will take up the jurisprudence of the court, it will formulate a policy proposal on basis of that, with the overall aim to re-establish legal certainty, but it's of course interpreted by the Commission the way to do so. So the Commission is the gatekeeper here, it is kind of the first forerunner in deciding how should we respond to the case law of the court. Then it presents a proposal, and afterwards we have the decision-making processes of the European Parliament and the Council, when this is ordinary decided by ordinary decision-making. And what we also see in these processes is that the political actors make use of the case law of the court, or they counteract it, and they do so at the various levels of daily decision-making. So being both in the committees of the European Parliament, by the rapporteurs, the shadow rapporteurs, by all the experts which are there, and also the experts in the Council working in the working groups, and so forth. In their kind of negotiation of the proposal from the Commission, the court's jurisprudence will come up, it will be used, it will be counteracted against, it will be disputed, and in that way it becomes a material in the political arena, one could say. So my interest is then how much of the original court jurisprudence here do we see reflected in the final policy output? And is this policy output somehow able to curb or contain what the court here engaged in? So on to the research question of the book. This is the formulation: to what extent and under which conditions do court decisions influence EU social policy output, that is, in EU secondary legislation. So it's both a question of to what extent and the way in which. That, of course, requires certain takes on it. First of all, I define social policy output broadly. So the social policy field is undergoing a broad definition here, both including labor market regulation and also healthcare. It is examined for the social policy between a long time period, so going back actually to 58, so the first policy proposals from the Commission concerning EU social regulation, and then taking up to 2014. And it is engaged in three detailed case studies which were unfolding as I did the study. So regulation of healthcare, regulation of posting of workers, and regulation of working time, the working time directive. And there I did process tracing studies. So these three cases are characterized by legal integration has taken place to a very extensive degree. And some kind of political response was requested here. There was a call for a political kind of clarification and response to what the court had initiated. It's also important to say that for patient rights and posting of workers, they were about interpretation of the treaty, so the highest institutional thresholds really respond to the Court of Justice. They were about constitutionalization, one could say. And that should foreclose actually a political response to these kind of decision-making processes. But that was important to include. And then, of course, what I am interested in here is, can jurisprudence lead to general change? That's a kind of social science question. Are they leading to change in public policies? Because I argue that then they become more effective. If they're taking from the partiality of ECJ decisions into a general legislative framework, they come from being only regulating the parties involved and, of course, similar cases, onto actually getting a more general feature and being more generally applicable. And then, of course, it's also a question of the more democratic influence of the Court of Justice on the EU legislative branches. So there are very many overall research questions also motivating this study, I will argue. That, of course, is not an easy thing to do in methodological terms. So how to do this? How can we get this study further so we better understand the interaction and the link between law and political legal and political integration? That is certainly methodologically demanding. So I'll just take a little bit of time to present how I did that. But before doing so, argue why the social policy area, I find, is a clear and a critical case for examining the law and politics dynamics here. It is because it has two very important features. First of all, it's one of the areas where most legal integration has taken place. So we see, when we look into the Courier database, that the area where third most cases from the European Court of Justice have been rendered is in the social area. So social provision here summed up with social security coordination. There's really a massive amount of legal integration which has gone on in this field. So that's one field. That's the one feature I needed for having a critical case, a field where legal integration has occurred. And the other, of course, feature I also needed was that there need to be a political engagement. There may be other fields of EU integration where it doesn't really matter that much to politics. But here there's something at stake. Here we should expect politics to mobilize, to engage. So that's the argument for having chosen the social policy area. I also argue that it is a critical case, therefore it has more abilities to be generalized also to other policy areas. Other policy areas where we also find this clash between legal integration and political integration, and where we find an interlink between the internal market and more national institutions, so to speak. But on to the methodological question, how can we examine judicial influence? What tools do we actually have for saying something about judicial impact beyond the courtroom? I do this in two ways. First, there's the definition of judicial influence. So judicial influence, according to my definition, takes place when a regulatory status quo, so this is what we thought the treaty meant, what we thought a piece of secondary legislation meant, is changed by a new status quo generated by the court. So, for example, the court saying that healthcare is also a service within the meaning of the treaty, or on-call time also constitute working time within the meaning of the working time directive. Is it then being codified into EU legislation, or is it being altered by EU legislation? This is the matter of then a judicial influence is taking place. Methodologically, and I actually worked quite a long time on getting the research design right, because it is not such an easy task. I did it in two ways, two approaches here. First, what I call a law attainment approach, which is really borrowed from how preference attainment by interest organization into policies is being researched. So this is taking all major policy binding acts and compiling them. So all the policy acts adopted in the social policy field between this time period, dating back to 58, and forward in time. And then collecting the original proposals from the Commission. This is also not so easy because many of them do not, the more historical ones, do not exist online, but by help from the archives of the Commission, we also got the original and old proposals from the Commission. Then we examined those proposals and coded them for the extent to which the Commission is referring to the case law of the court and justifying articles, provisions, recitals, or principles of the proposal on basis of the case law of the court. And then we follow the legislative process afterwards, the amendments from the European Parliament, the amendments from the European Council, the Council of Ministers, excuse me, and the extent to which they then are trying to modify what the Commission is presenting as accepting the jurisprudence of the court, comparing that with the final policy output. So this is sort of the methodological law attainment approach. But in addition to that, we did a process tracing study of these three cases unfolding as we did, in order to examine how political actors were then using the case law of the court in the political processes, and how the Commission formulated its policy position on basis of the case law of the court. So we did interviews with 78 key respondents involved in these decision-making processes, so council representatives, Commission civil servants, rapporteurs, shadow rapporteurs from the European Parliament, representatives from the national parliaments, and so forth, to cover the wide range of policy actors involved in this process. But you also very soon see that actually there are few actors which are the true experts in a policy field when it's being decided on in the European Union. So to get access to them was really key here, and to see how they then respond actively and ongoing to the case law of the court. And they do. The case law of the court is a real feature in political decision making. So if we see to the kind of established paradigms of the law and politics relationship, I find that it's presented in a very dichotomous way, as there are two possible ways that politics can respond to law. Either it can override legal integration, or it can accept it. It can codify it fully. But in the true decision-making processes, there's a range of policy responses in between, where actually political actors are also oftentimes responding by modification. So they are not able to establish a sufficient majority to either codify or override the case law of the court, but what they are able to is to establish a compromise where they exert exemptions, can be opt-out, can be special rules, can be a strong ability to exert national control in secondary legislation, which is regaining control on the policy output or policy implication of legal decision-making. But these do not feature very highly in the public debate, or you are not able to see them unless you actually do this very detailed documentary study or question or observe the political decision making as it takes place. But they are key to establish compromises, and they do actually establish important modifications to what becomes the implication of ECJ decision making. Other times, political actors are not able to even establish a majority to modify the implications of the court, and it ends up in a non-adoption. So simply, there is a clear conflict line here. That was what happened in the Working Time Directive, and no decision is taken, so we end up in a non-decision, but that should not be mistaken as acceptance. You can see that in implementation. So the taxonomy here is to say that these two dichotomous understanding of political responses to legal integration do not capture what is really going on in decision-making processes. And actually, from my point of view, what creates a much larger degree of legitimacy to these decision-making processes also. Because this is the best we can do. This is suboptimality. This is not, it is not a perfect or an absolute way of responding to the case law of the court, but it gives the democratic mandate also to the process of legal integration or integration in general. So, for these three case studies that I did here, we have working time where the Commission suggested a modification of the case law of the court, so inactive on-call time should not calculate as working time. But that was not approved by the member states, and we have ended up in a decision of a non-decision, where we have a non-adoption and we have a high degree of legal uncertainty. And what have the member states done in such a situation? They certainly haven't just implemented then what the court said. No, more and more member states has adopted the British opt-out from the working time to shield from the implication of the case law of the court. So we have seen over time that there actually is a huge differentiation going on in the regulation of working time, where more and more member states adopt opt-outs. So we now, as one of my respondents said, have an Emmentaler. It resembles an Emmentaler with holes larger than cheese, of course. Or it's a rule that nobody abides, was also said by the respondents here. If we go on to healthcare, this is the timeline for healthcare regulation, a very, very lengthy one, and of course it never ends. But fair to say here is that the Commission first proposed to codify the case law of the court into the Services Directive, but that was vetoed first by the European Parliament, but anyway it would never have been flying the way the Commission presented to codify the case law of the court. And then it got a separate proposal for a directive, the Patient Rights Directive, which what happened in the political decision making was that a much more national control with what healthcare you can actually get in another member state was inserted. So a clear modification of the case law of the court. And then if we go on to something which is very current, so it's negotiated, or was at least Monday, the posting of workers regulation, the Commission there argued both in the Monti II regulation and in the enforcement directive very, very heavily for codifying the case law of the court. But we know that for the Monti II regulation, that was vetoed by the national parliaments. So for the first time, the national parliament threw a yellow card. And with the enforcement directives, key principles were clearly modified, and therefore the full impact of the case law of the court was reduced. And now we see a very interesting negotiation where actually in the new proposal for reforming the Posting of Workers Directive, there's only one reference to the case law of the court, and it's the new case, the new Finnish case, so it is departing from the Laval Quartet, which used to be so impacting on this complex of law and politics interaction. So, concluding very quickly, my findings do not support juridicalization of politics as profound and expanding. The overall finding in the book demonstrates how the broader reach of jurisprudence result from a continuous interplay between law and politics. So, an interplay where interpretations and perceptions, but also interest of political actors, matter for judicial influence on politics and policy outputs. So the law attainment approach here demonstrate variation of judicial influence, so very clear variation, where modification is able to limit the impact of these judicial decisions. So you could say that the many expectations, but also challenges, the fears and the high hopes of a court's jurisprudence does not come out like that in the end. So by studying the political decision-making process, you can see that the political reactions to the court's jurisprudence indeed is part of explaining why some court decisions get a more general impact while others do not. So we see that judicial influence indeed varies over time. We see that its codification happened more in the early period of jurisprudence. It also happens more whereas there's not so much politically at stake. But when there is political preferences mobilized, codification is just as difficult as overriding the case law of the court. It faces just as high institutional thresholds to come through in that way in policy outputs. It needs also to be proposed by the Commission. It also needs to be adopted by the Council and the European Parliament. And if those political actors are against it, why should they codify? They don't. They modify if they can agree. So we see that modification is becoming a more likely response, and that is giving a political touch to the impact of legal integration, but a very important political touch to it, which actually, from my view, is key also to understand the more, or to take forward the more democratic discussion on the interplay between law and politics. So I do find, both in my studies on the legislative responses to legal integration, but also when studying how legal integration had been implemented and impacting at the national level, that if we maintain this view of the interplay as either or, either codification or full acceptance, if we are still sort of stuck in the idea that you can only, that due to constitutionalization, due to strong juridicalization, extremely important policy options are gone. They will never again materialize in the age of Europeanization. We actually disregard those other policy options that are arising. Because politics is, of course, responding also in rather innovative ways, in creative ways sometimes, maybe not due to political actors, but then due to their civil servants, due to the consensus established in different decision-making forums and so forth. And that exactly gives the political touch to legal and political integration as of now. And I think I should stop here.
Thank you very much indeed.